From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The interview we promised with Jan Wenner didn't work out, but we do have some good news for rock fans. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear interviews with David Byrne and record producer and keyboardist Mitchell Froom. Froom produced the latest albums by Suzanne Vega and Los Lobos, as well as albums by Richard Thompson and Elvis Costello. He'll tell us how he gets around the tyranny of the band and the tyranny of the studio. Also, David Byrne tells us about his solo career and his years with Talking Heads. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Reservoir Dogs, starring Harvey Keitel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Republicans and Democrats in the Senate reelected their leadership in party caucuses today. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
There were no contested races on the Democratic side, according to Maine Democrat George Mitchell, who was reelected majority leader. Bob Dole was also reelected as Republican leader. The number two Republican job, that of minority whip, will continue to be held by Wyoming's Alan Simpson, who beat back a challenge. And Texas Senator Phil Graham had a narrower win, holding on to the chairmanship of the National Republican Senatorial Committee by one vote. Dole says the job of Senate Republicans this year is to provide constructive opposition. Simpson says one aim is to keep Democrats from reapproving some of the measures vetoed by President Bush.
And we're going to see more creative stuff, but we'll get motor voter, Hatch Act reform. They'll try to trot out a great cage full of turkeys, and we'll be right there to strangle half of them.
Senate Republicans say they'll also be on the lookout for a massive wave of new spending by Democrats. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
A high State Department official was dismissed today for her role in improperly speeding up the search of the passport records of President-elect Bill Clinton and those of his mother. Assistant Secretary of State Elizabeth Tamposi was relieved of her duties on the recommendation of Acting Secretary Lawrence Eagleburger. The Washington Post reported today that Tamposi also expedited searches of Ross Perot's passport records. Perot was quoted as calling the search a gross abuse of power, and a Clinton spokesman called for a full report. Tamposi is a former state legislator from New Hampshire and a former Republican fundraiser who was appointed to her post in 1988. The president of Macedonia, the poorest of the Balkan states, is in Washington today for high-level meetings at the State Department. The president wants recognition of his country and an end to a punishing oil embargo imposed by the Greeks. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
For the past 3 months, the Greek government has blocked oil deliveries to Skopje, the Macedonian capital. The Greek embassy claims that oil destined for Macedonia has found its way to Serbia, breaking the United Nations sanctions against that country. However, Western officials say that Greece is openly violating UN sanctions by sending oil to Serbia. There is substantial flow of oil to Serbia from Greece, according to Western sources. The revelation raises questions about the motive behind Athens' embargo of Macedonia, which has caused economic chaos in the country. The Greek government has blocked Western recognition of Macedonia until Macedonia changes its name. Athens says it has exclusive rights to the historic title. Macedonia is also the name of a Greek province. In London, this is Deborah Amos.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 15 points to close at 3,225. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading of 222 million shares. This is NPR. The State Department said today that it's expelling a Cuban diplomat from the United Nations mission in New York for alleged spying. Spokesman Richard Boucher said the man, a third secretary in Cuba's UN delegation, must leave the United States within 48 hours. He said the FBI has considerable information indicating that the man was engaged in espionage. The United States has not had diplomatic or trade relations with Cuba since Fidel Castro established a communist government there more than 30 years ago. Brazil's justice minister has persuaded an Indian tribe in the northern Amazon rainforest to release 86 non-Indian hostages they'd been holding for the past 8 days. NPR's David Wellner reports from Rio de Janeiro.
During a tense 3-hour meeting today deep in the Amazon, chieftains from the Guajajara Indian tribe avoided a potential bloodletting with federal troops by agreeing to free their captives. Guajajara warriors had seized the 86 hostages from passenger buses last Monday, shortly after the son of a Guajajara chieftain was shot and killed by non-Indian settlers. The Indians had earlier refused to release the hostages until the Brazilian government expelled several thousand non-Indians from a settlement inside Guajajara territory. Officials today promised this would be done, although similar promises in the past have been broken. To make sure the authorities keep their word this time, the Guajajara are holding on to the 7 buses from which they took the hostages. They'll only give them up once the outsiders have been expelled. I'm David Walnut in Rio de Janeiro.
Analysts welcomed today's news that inflation remained low at the wholesale level in October, saying it should give the incoming Clinton administration more leeway to stimulate the economy. The Labor Department reported that wholesale prices rose by a modest 0.1% last month, less than many Wall Street economists had been expecting. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We often interview rock performers on Fresh Air, and we were beginning to notice a trend. Some of the more interesting albums by performers who had been our guests, like Richard Thompson, Los Lobos, Elvis Costello, and Peter Case, were produced by Mitchell Froom. Once we realized that, we figured it was time to invite Froom to talk with us. This seemed like a good time to do it. He produced the latest albums by Suzanne Vega and Los Lobos. Suzanne Vega came out of the folk scene. Her new album, 99.9 Fahrenheit Degrees, has a different, much noisier sound. Let's listen to Blood Makes Noise. I asked producer Mitchell Froom if Suzanne Vega came to him with a specific idea of what she wanted on this album.
I think she was just interested in having her records have a little bit more projection and a little more intensity. And she had made some different kinds of demos before we got together and sent them off to a few people, and I guess she liked what I said the best, so I got the job.
What did you say?
Well, I'd liked her acoustic demos better than the band demos that she had done, and I told her why, and I think basically the idea was that I'd felt that in the past, perhaps the musicians that had worked on her records tended to listen more to the tone of her voice and the prettiness of her guitar playing and not pay as much attention to the lyrics, and so oftentimes the music tended to get a little bit pretty, whereas I thought it would be a lot more interesting if the music reflected the darkness of what she was talking about. So,
does that lead to your overall vision for the record?
Yeah, I did a lot of thinking about it, and then things just developed pretty quickly. We got together and worked in a little rehearsal studio, the two of us, just with her playing guitar and singing, and I just had a few keyboards, and just tried to figure out, I mean, her music is actually, I think, in its most natural state, wants to be kind of a weird hybrid of things, and that's kind of what I think we got onto anyway, I hope.
Mitchell Froom, you've also produced the latest record by Los Lobos. Give us a sense of what your overall vision was for this album.
That record really was, it had a particular quality about it. I mean, we had spoken up front about how, you know, we weren't going to be confined by the tyranny of the band necessarily, and that we were just going to experiment. But it became, as it progressed, it really became kind of, I hate to use the word breakthrough, but it, it had that quality to it, and it was for them, and it was for me, and it was for the engineer that I work with, and we just came up with all these notions and all these ideas, and we just kept getting wilder and wilder and less afraid as we went along, and it was just a lot of fun. Nothing took very much time, but we got on to some fairly radical things, I think, pretty quickly. And
what's an example of one of the radical things you tried on this?
Well, you know, again, like Suzanne's record, it's kind of a weird hybrid of numbers of different kinds of music, but it, you know, just put together, hopefully, in kind of an unexpected way, like, you know, Kiko and the Lavender Moon. Some people have thought that it kind of has some Ellington-style harmonies to it, you know, with sort of a Cuban beat, and then there's a guitar in there that sounds like it was recorded in Egypt sometime. And, you know, there's just a lot of strange things going on, and it somehow doesn't sound like it's being smug or trying to be too clever with itself. At least I hope not. That's not the way it strikes me. I really love that track.
On the track Kiko and the Lavender Moon, did you do any of the arranging on that track? What was your contribution to the sound?
Well, what sounds like saxophones is actually a keyboard that I'd played just along with the track, thinking that we were going to replace it later with Steve Berlin, you know, on saxophones. But that particular keyboard, it just had such an atmosphere about it that we just left it. But basically, all the parts in the song David had come up with up front, you know, even the quality of that saxophone part, the harmonic content of that was stuff that he had come up with. I helped orchestrate it somewhat, but we did that very quickly. It becomes one of these things where between the engineer and the band and myself, that ideas just bounce around and you try things quickly and throw them away. And, you know, we did that whole track, I think, in a day and a half, and what you hear was a 5-minute rough mix of the song.
You kept the rough mix?
Yeah, sometimes, particularly with something like that, there becomes a blend that you can't ever get back.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried for not very long to beat it, and then we just decided we'd live with a little more tape hiss, and maybe the world would forgive us, you know?
right. You use the expression "the tyranny of the band." What did you mean by that?
Oftentimes, when a group is together a long time, and they found things that work initially, they tend to bring the same thing to the music as time goes on, figuring, well, it worked once, so it works again, and it's hard to shake that up, and you have to be willing to look at a recording not as a documentation of live performance, but as a recording in itself. And if there was a switch, that was probably, you know, that was probably the switch of that. They really didn't care who did what and how anything happened. And the roles were changed all around. You know, that it's just a difficult thing sometimes. Bands have upsides and downsides. And the downsides can be that after a while bands play the same way. You know, they hear a new song and they'll just play it the same way they played an old one. and it won't be as good because it doesn't have any discovery to it or any tension to it. You know, they're just too comfortable with it, so.
Why don't we listen to Angels with Dirty Faces? I'm going to play this because I like the way the synthesizers and drums are integrated together.
Uh-huh. You know, there's no synthesizers.
There's no synthesizer, okay.
No.
So why am I thinking that there is?
I'm not sure. I think a lot of it has to do with the recording technique.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of distortion used. There is a little bit of a loop going on. But that comes from a strange little instrument that's called a stereophonic optagon that was made, I think, by Sears in the 60s. And it's a very small part of it, but it kind of creates the impression that there's a record scratching along with the, you know, your surface noise. But, you know, for example, I think the drums on that track were recorded onto just one track with one microphone with some really rotten distorting compressors. And so, you know, it actually, there's very little going on in that. There's definitely no synthesizers.
Now, the rotten distorting compressors, were they intentionally rotten and distorting?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the engineer I work with, Chad Blake, that's his particular, you know, that's his particular specialty, is that sort of thing. And
what do you like about the sound it gives you?
Well, it sounds like it's breathing, and a big thing about that record for us as a team, because we've worked together now almost 7 years, and with that record, for the first time, I think we really felt like we came on to something that was more unique and could be applied in different ways to different people. So it's not like, you know, some producers are associated with a sound, and it's not like that sort of thing. It's not you know, trying to mold artists to your sound, but it's a helpful way of just getting some soul and some rawness into a record. You know, people always try to get that thing of the way old records sound, and a huge part of it is the fact that recording techniques weren't as pristine, and there was a lot of distortion going on, the high end wasn't as clear, and the result was just the music sounded much rawer. And in those days, you know, like, for example, if you listen to some of the Stax catalog, they were trying to make the music sound as pretty as they could. That's just the best they could do, but it still had this great raw sound. Now we have so many options and so many ways of cleaning things up that you tend to forget, you know, what the function of instruments are and the emotion of them can be. So in addition to getting away from the tyranny of the band-type situation with Los Lobos, I felt we also got away from the tyranny of the studio.
Right. Let's listen to Angels with Dirty Faces.
With one shoe on and one shoe lost, stands a wounded man. Just laughs it off. The angels with dirty faces go it alone. And the angels with dirty faces go it alone.
Usually when you produce an album, you're also featured on keyboards. You're credited on the Los Lobos records as Mitchell Froom and his house of keyboards.
Right.
Now, there's someone, you know, who already plays keyboards in the band. How do you decide who's going to do what there?
It doesn't make any difference. In fact, a few played keyboards. David played piano on the record, and Steve Berlin played. And, for example, on that song, Just a Man, David suggested I play the piano part, but but he had written it, and I liked the way he played it better than I could. There was more more struggle in there, should we say. You know, I would have probably done it a little bit smoother, and it just doesn't matter. And the reason why I have a house of keyboards is they're mostly old keyboards that have weird overtones and react different ways every time you play them, and it's that sort of thing. And the reason why I have them around is so that there can be situations where somebody who doesn't play at all can sit down and find a couple notes they like, and then that'll be it.
Mm-hmm. You know,
there's the quality of that record was one that, of very little ego anywhere. You know, they had Steve Berlin is a record producer in his own right, and he was extremely helpful, and he was really great about the whole process. There was no tension between us about what was going on. We just wanted the music to be good. And as long as there's that kind of quality to the thing, and it's not a pompous situation, or people aren't overly smug about what they're doing, and that the focus is always just on what's coming out of the speakers, things tend to work out better.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mitchell Froom. He's a record producer who's produced records for Los Lobos, Suzanne Vega, Elvis Costello, Richard Thompson, Peter Case, and others. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Record producer Mitchell Froom is my guest. What is the job of record producer, the way you would define it?
It's belonging to a club that you're not proud of. well, in the best of all worlds, I would hope that being a record producer is being able to identify where it is that you're needed and to be able to provide that service, which means understanding your own limitations and figuring out what it is that you may be able to offer your assistance in what way. And my ideas have been changing over the years about it, but I think that's basically the job.
Yeah,
my problem is that I'm, like I say, I'm not particularly proud of the company that I keep. I think, in general, that records would be better without record producers.
Why?
Well, you hear demo tapes that have a lot of personality, and then you hear a generic version of that once the record comes out. And even though there may be more rough edges, or the arrangement may not be what you would call standard song form, those are all the things that are great about it. And so many records get lost in the shuffle, and so much personality goes by the wayside.
Is that because, do you think the record company wants it that way, or is it just that the personality of the producer is so big it overwhelms that of the performer?
Well, there's a one thing is that I've noticed is that record company involvement oftentimes, now fortunately this is not on records that I tend to work on, but they tend to fixate on saying that the artist needs really great songs. Their definition of what a great song is usually the opposite of my definition of what a great song is, which is they like the standard form, the well-crafted, predictable type song. And, you know, why should somebody have a chorus at all if they don't want a chorus? You know, if they have a good idea and what they're doing has emotion to it, why should it be constricted into a form? And then the record producer gets a hold of it, and there nowadays, like I mentioned, there's just a lot of ways to go wrong in the studio. There's I think it was much easier making records when there was less tracks, when fidelity was worse, and there was less money to be made, because things were done quickly, and if it was good, it was good, and you could tell right away, and you just get things the best they could be, and then they're done. But nowadays, there's so many things that you can do, and there's so many ways to get distracted. And oftentimes I see record producers with the idea of, well, this is my production, and so everything is going to be just right. I don't want to be known for any kind of shabby work. And the result of that kind of thinking is often a record with no warts. And it's depressing.
How often do you use synthesizers on rhythm tracks in your productions?
Synthesizers? I've got some synthesizers, but I don't think I don't remember the last time I used them. I have some analog ones. It's another thing that kind of saddens me about the state of music nowadays is I don't think I've heard a keyboard that's new that has any kind of sound to it that I can even relate to. And I don't know how someone who's coming up and is faced with that can even function in the world. There seems to be this trend, and you even see it in pianos, and you see it in guitars, and you see it in definitely synthesizers, where any possible overtone is gotten rid of, and every sound is finished and polished and has absolutely nothing to offer. No, there's no personality. And even here in grand pianos, they've managed to take the overtones out of things so they can get a very pristine sound, and there's no character to it. So how is anyone, if they're a serious pianist, how are they going to find the notes that may have more character? And, you know, I've heard classical pianists say that they find the four or five notes that are great and they try to emphasize them. That might be a bit much, but there's just nothing to lean on with these things.
You've played in bands on tour. You've toured with Elvis Costello. You've toured with Richard Thompson. How do you
I never toured with Richard Thompson.
You just played with him on in the studio?
Yeah.
Okay.
I wish I would have, but... And Elvis, I really only toured with the Confederates, but it was only about 4 weekends, so I wish I could have done more. That was really, really fun. I was honored to be in that company of those musicians. That was really great.
Well, how do you like being on stage as opposed to in the studio?
Well, I've been thinking about doing more, and I've played live with Tom Waits a few times when he's through L.A., and this group Crowded House I work with, I usually play with them, and I've you know, when Elvis comes through town, if he wants, I'll play. It's just the thing. It's just the idea of being able to throw the notes out there and not having to hear them back is really fun. And I think it would maybe do me some good to do some more of that.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I'm very flattered that you asked me.
Mitchell Froom is a record producer based in L.A. He produced the latest albums by Suzanne Vega and Los Lobos, as well as albums by Richard Thompson and Elvis Costello. This is Fat Man and Dancing Girl from Suzanne Vega's new album, 99.9 Fahrenheit Degrees. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
White flatland, no shadow or shade of a doubt, where the megaphone man met the girl with her hand that's covering most of her mouth. Fall in love with a bright idea and the way the world is revealed to you. Fat man and dancing girl, and most of the show is concealed from view. Monkey in the middle, keep singing that tune. I don't want to hear it, get rid of it soon. MC on the stage tonight is a man named Billy Pearl. He's the international fun boy, and he knows the worth of a beautiful girl.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up from the avant-garde to the traditional and back again, we talk with David Byrne about the group he co-founded, Talking Heads. Since the group disbanded, he's explored Latin and African music, but with his latest album, Uh-Oh, he's returned to the sound he developed with Talking Heads. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Reservoir Dogs, starring Harvey Keitel. It's about a botched jewel heist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A senior State Department official linked to the improper search of President-elect Bill Clinton's passport files during the recent presidential campaign has been dismissed. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Elizabeth Tamposi, Assistant Secretary of State for Consular Affairs, must be out of her office by close of business tomorrow. Tamposi is a political appointee named to her post by George Bush, and it was Bush who effectively dismissed her today. Her office accelerated a search of Bill Clinton's passport files in violation of the State Department's own rules, and today's Washington Post reports that her subordinates also searched the passport files of independent candidate Ross Perot before the election. Department spokesman Richard Boucher said an internal investigation of all this is nearing completion.
And it should be finished within a few days. It will be made public in its entirety.
Today, Perot and a spokesman for Clinton both called the passport file searches an abuse of federal power. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
President-elect Bill Clinton had another low-profile day in Little Rock, Arkansas. He took more calls this morning from foreign leaders, and he continued to work this afternoon on transition matters. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Clinton met with Vice President-elect Al Gore at the governor's mansion in Little Rock today, and with Warren Christopher, the director of his transition effort. Christopher participated in a half-hour conference call with the board of the transition. According to Clinton's spokesman, George Stephanopoulos, the board is presenting the president-elect with options about the timetable for appointments and for an economic summit, a meeting of business leaders, academics, and members of Congress that Clinton plans to convene sometime in December. Stephanopoulos said while it was unlikely Clinton would announce cabinet or staff appointments this week, he would appoint more members of the transition team. Sources in the transition say Stephanopoulos himself is expected to be named deputy transition director. The president-elect is also expected to announce what Stephanopoulos calls a full package of ethics rules and lobbying restrictions later this week. During the campaign, Clinton promised to ban former government officials from lobbying their agencies for 5 years after leaving government service. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
New York State's chief judge has resigned hours after a federal court placed him under house arrest. Judge Saul Walker had been arrested over the weekend on charges that he tried to blackmail a former lover and threatened to kidnap her teenage daughter. The 62-year-old Walker had been under a suicide watch at a Long Island hospital and now has been ordered to leave his home only to consult with attorneys or doctors. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 15 points to close at 3,225.47 on volume of more than 222 million shares. This is NPR News. According to top UN peacekeeping officials in Bosnia, a Red Cross convoy carrying refugees from Sarajevo to Croatia has been stopped by Serbian forces. Some 14 buses are said to be stranded about 18 miles from the capital. On board these buses are a number of children and older people with little food or water. Plans to carry another load of 1,000 people to Belgrade also ran into problems today when buses failed to turn up for most of them. Red Cross officials hope to take up to 6,000 people out of Sarajevo, which has been under siege now for more than 6 months. A study in tomorrow's Journal of the American Medical Association suggests that patients who are urged to undergo a type of heart X-ray might do well to seek a second opinion. David Barron of member station WBUR reports.
Angiography is a common and costly procedure that allows doctors to locate constricted arteries in the heart by injecting a dye that makes blood flow visible on X-rays. Once the blockages are found, patients often undergo treatment, including bypass surgery, to correct the problem. But researchers at the Lound Cardiovascular Center near Boston say cheaper and less invasive tests using treadmills and ultrasound are adequate for many patients. The physicians use these procedures to study patients who'd already been recommended for angiography. Dr. Thomas Grayboys led the research team.
80% of the patients we saw did not need a procedure. And when they were followed up for 4 years, they had a very, very low complication or very low mortality rate.
Grayboys estimates more than half the angiography performed in this country is unnecessary. For National Public Radio, I'm David Barron in Boston.
National League baseball owners have turned down a $115 million offer from a Florida group to buy the Giants, thus ruling the Giants will stay in San Francisco. The owners ruled against the plan by a vote of 9-4. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest David Byrne first became known as the co-founder, lead singer, and primary songwriter of Talking Heads, a band that started out as part of the New York new wave scene of the 70s. They later expanded their sound with African and funk influences, and Byrne went off to do his own projects. He worked with producer Brian Eno, composed music for the Twyla Tharp Dance Company, and directed the film True Stories. Eventually, Talking Heads broke up, and Byrne became infatuated with Latin music. He started his own record label, in which he's released anthologies of contemporary South and Central American music, as well as his own Latin-inspired music. But his latest album, Uh-Oh, returns to the style he developed with Talking Heads. Before we meet him, let's hear Girls on My Mind from his new album, Uh-Oh. David Byrne, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Thanks.
Your latest record, Uh-Oh, in a way returns to your Talking Heads style of songwriting and of singing. And I'm wondering, like, what prompted that return?
I think it was unconscious. I don't think it was intentional. I think with this separation of the band, in retrospect, it seems that I had to kind of make a clean break and wipe the slate clean. And not for a while, not do anything that in any way had any similarity to what I'd done with Talking Heads. Although it was natural for me to do music that sounded a little bit like that, I think unconsciously I just stayed away from it.
Mm-hmm. You know, when Talking Heads started, I thought of your music then as being very pared down instrumentally, vocally, even visually, and that the band would like wear T-shirts on stage. And I'm wondering. How much impact the music of other cultures had on you in your sense of stage presence, you know, theatrical presence, both in the way that you dress and even in the sense of like arrangements and how big they should be, and what the difference is finally to you between slick and show busy and just like good theatrical.
It seems to me that when a lot of people start out, whether it's a choreographer, a musician, or theater, or whatever, that you often start out by throwing out everything from the past, and you pare things down to just the essentials, to what you feel comfortable with. And gradually, it seems that you can, there's more and more that you feel comfortable with, that you understand about performing and about this stage and musical ideas, and so you can kind of include more and more elements in what you do. I think, for me, when Talking Heads first started touring, after a few years of touring, I saw lots of different kinds of theatrical practice, whether it was music shows or kabuki theater or whatever. And eventually I came to accept that, it seems really obvious, but I came to accept that the stage is a really artificial place to be. No matter how much I might kind of strip down and kind of want to show my real self or just be an ordinary guy or whatever, it's impossible because the stage is not a place where anybody can be ordinary, or the idea of having realism on a stage is kind of bogus, because as soon as you put something on stage, it's not real anymore. It's about artifice. And so I kind of at some point accepted that that artifice is part of what goes on stage, whether it's music or theater or whatever. And it just depends on how you want to use it.
You've been criticized by some people for your explorations into the musics of other cultures, criticized for being something of a dilettante and for not, you know, because you haven't studied these musics all your life, so when you go in, you don't completely understand the culture and the history and so on. How do you react to those criticisms?
I would say that some of the best music in the world is made by people who hear something and they don't know exactly what it is and they don't know exactly where it comes from, and they kind of incorporate it into what they do. And that includes Africans who incorporate a lot of rock and roll and Cuban music and R&B, and Americans who incorporated a lot of African music over the years. You can kind of go all over the world and find any kind of, just about any kind of music, and somewhere in there there's an example of it absorbing other traditions into it. It just seems like that's the way music evolves.
Let me play something from your recent album, Ray Momo, and I thought we'd hear Independence Day. Would you like to say something about the song?
What could I say about it? The rhythm is a cumbia, which is popular in Colombia and a lot of Mexico. They play it slightly different in Mexico. There's even a version of a cumbia played in Texas in the southwest of the U.S., which is also quite different, but I'm sure there's a connection somewhere.
Okay, well, let's hear Independence Day from David Byrne's album, Ray Momo.
Now and then I get horny, at night you do, at night you do, smile from side to side, at night you do, at night you do. She'll be coming round the mountain, six white horses by her side, no stops for gas, food or lodging, she's wearing nothing but a smile. Though we struggle for our freedom, our need for others still remains.
That's David Byrne from his album, Ray Momo. He'll be back with us after this short break. This is Fresh Air. David Byrne is my guest. You were born in Scotland and moved to the States, I believe, when you were in second grade. Why did your family decide to move here?
It was work. The shipyards were all closing down in Scotland, and in other areas there was very, very little work. So the American companies, in this case Westinghouse, were offering trained people in Europe. I think it was they'd pay for the passage of that person and their family if they promised to work for him for a number of years. It was kind of like indentured servants. It was also known as, I guess, the brain drain, because they were getting a lot of trained people out of Europe to run, and not run, but work in American factories. This was in the 50s.
So your father was an engineer with the company?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And when you moved here, did you have an accent? Were you self-conscious about being from a different country?
Yeah, I think I must have been, because I would have been in elementary school, and very shortly I lost my accent because the other kids couldn't understand me. And I probably did it to fit in. So, I mean, at that age, it's real important to fit in.
Yeah, so you didn't like being different then?
Nuh-uh. I wanted to be like everybody else.
A big change from who you became, right? So why did you first take up music?
Everybody was doing it then.
Yeah, everybody had a guitar.
Yeah, everybody had a guitar or drums or something. Everybody was being in a band. So I thought, I'll do that.
Did you teach yourself?
Yeah, you know, got, you know, those instruction books.
And the method books?
Yeah, the method books.
Which one did you have?
It was called Mel Bay.
Mel Bay, okay.
Yeah.
what were the songs in that book?
Oh, you know, I don't remember.
Let me play something from the first Talking Heads album, Talking Heads 77. And I really love this record, and I think every time I play it, it really holds up. There's nothing that sounds dated about it. I thought I would play Baby, It's You, or Who Is It? It's called.
That's a short one, yeah.
Yeah, well, I tell you, you know, I think of Talking Heads in the early days as having had a really pared-down style, and I think this song really...
It sure is pared down.
It sure is pared down, yeah. Uh-huh. It's really catchy. I really love this song. It's almost kind of like the semiotics of rock lyrics, too, you know?
Uh-huh.
Just like, baby, it's you.
Yep, that's about it, too.
Yeah. Do you want to say anything about writing this?
Yeah, that's kind of what it was. I thought, well, I'll pare a song down to really just... Just bare essentials, kind of no verse, no chorus, just with three words or whatever, and there you go.
Let's hear it. Who is it?
What is it? I remembered something else about when I started writing songs that ended up being a lot of them being Talking Heads songs.
Uh-huh.
Is that I had a feeling about the lyrics of rock and roll songs. I had a feeling that there was this kind of ongoing tradition of kind of stylized lyrics, whether it was meant people pretending they were black and from the South or whatever. There was this whole kind of genre or style of writing lyrics for rock and roll songs. And I just thought, I'm going to throw all that out and try and write in a just real straightforward style and use language that is not song language. That's more either kind of, it's more like written language or spoken language, but it's not the kind of accepted song language. I'm going to see if that works. I think some of it worked. Some of it didn't, but I think some of it worked.
Why did Talking Heads eventually split apart?
I think, well, I'm not sure. I think the seeds of a kind of the disillusion of a band are kind of planted the minute a band begins to have some success. It's as if that the thing that makes it grow and succeed is also the thing that's going to eventually kill it. And I think that's as you succeed, as we kind of survived anyway, we found that we each needed our own space, we each developed our own friends, and part of that was just out of necessity. We'd been hanging around each other so much that if we kept hanging in such close quarters, we would have been killing one another. So out of necessity, we gradually kind of drifted apart a little bit. And so for a number of years, I guess, we kind of maintained a balance of keeping our own lives separate from the band and then coming together and making music. Mm-hmm. And eventually, I guess it just gets to be more than, at least from my point of view, more than makes sense. It becomes more like a business than it started out being. So that eventually you drift apart further and further until it gets to a point where you start wondering, why are we working together? Who are these people? I hardly know this person anymore. That kind of thing, which is, it's sad, but it seems like it's natural too.
Do you think you'd ever work together again?
It's possible, but we certainly don't have any plans to.
You know what you said about how often what's most responsible for a band's success is also what kills it. Do you worry about that yourself as a solo performer, that the things that bring you success are also the things that can stunt your growth?
Oh, exactly, yeah. I mean, too much success in one thing, you're all of a sudden you're trapped. All of a sudden it's like, that's what you're known for, people are going to expect you to do that again, or if you don't do it again, they're going to be disappointed, and all that kind of stuff, yeah.
So how have you tried to work around that?
Tried and to avoid success, you know? I don't know. Just being aware of it, I guess, is enough.
Okay, well, David Byrne, thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay.
David Byrne's latest album is Uh-Oh. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on the latest developments in the trade war?
Well, we'll be hearing from a French economics journalist in Washington and an American economist who specializes in international economics on their outlook for the next couple of months in this trade dispute. It's not a very rosy one either. Economist Gary Hofbauer thinks that President Bill Clinton will inherit a near crisis on his desk in January. Also news today of the State Department official who looked into Bill Clinton's visa files being fired from her job. And Frank Browning explores the origin of the apple in its birthplace, formerly Soviet Kazakhstan.
Thanks, Robert. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Quentin Tarantino was working in a video store when he decided he could make better movies than the ones he was selling. By the time he had written, directed, and acted in Reservoir Dogs, a lot of people agreed. It quickly became a film festival hit. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to see what all the commotion's about.
You could say this for Tarantino. He borrows from the best. His movie starts out like Diner, with a bunch of guys philosophizing over breakfast about life and love and, in this case, Madonna. But then the credits roll, and when we come out of them, we're suddenly in the middle of a hectic 50s-style heist movie, like The Asphalt Jungle or The Killing. The guys we've just seen deconstructing Papa Don't Preach have just pulled off a diamond theft. And something has gone terribly wrong, because one of them, the one played superbly by Tim Roth, is in the backseat of a getaway car bleeding profusely, while his comrade, played by Harvey Keitel, drives. But wait a minute, there's too much blood for a 50s heist movie. And too much rock music, too. By the end of Reservoir Dogs, Tarantino has committed a dozen heists of his own, from Martin Scorsese, Jim Jarmusch, the Coen brothers, and Sam Peckinpah. And he gets away with it. Reservoir Dogs is punchy and energetic and funny, with beefy performances and a compelling kind of in-your-face virtuosity. The movie takes place mostly in the warehouse the gang repairs to after their crime. There they wait for their boss and try to figure out which one of them squealed to the police. There's a lot of macho ranting and raving. A lot of jumpy handheld camera work, gunpointing, threatening. And there's one ferocious, almost unbearable scene in which a gang member tortures a cop that his buddies have tied to a chair. Tarantino doesn't flinch through any of this. The movie's gory and often unnerving, but maybe the most disturbing thing about it is that Tarantino depicts these mouthy crooks as overgrown children, as schoolyard brats playing cops and robbers, only with real cops and real robberies. Just listen to this scene in which their boss, a grand old thug played by the B-movie star Lawrence Tierney, gives them the pseudonyms they use throughout the film.
Here are your names. Mr. Brown, Mr. White, Mr. Blonde, Mr. Blue, Mr. Orange, Mr. Pink.
Why can't we pick our own colors?
No way, no way. Tried it once and doesn't work. You get four guys all fighting over who's going to be Mr. Black. But they don't know each other, so nobody wants to back down. No way. I pick. You're Mr. Pink.
How about if I'm Mr. Purple? I mean, that sounds good to me. I'll be Mr. Purple.
You're not Mr. Purple. Some guy on some other job is Mr. Purple. You're Mr. Pink.
Who cares what your name is?
Yeah, that's easy for you to say. You're Mr. White. You have a cool-sounding name.
Let's go to work.
Tarantino's insistence on the childishness of his characters has bugged a lot of critics. They think the movie would be more interesting if the conspirators were the sort of hard-bitten, grown-up toughies they probably would have been in those 50s movies. I think just the opposite. The boyish amorality of these robbers is Tarantino's point, and it rings especially true in an age of high school metal detectors and playground rubouts. Still, once he's established that angle, he can't figure out what to do with it, and the movie winds up feeling like a single joke with a dozen variations. Reservoir Dogs is at once too much and too little. It's entertaining and frightening and even thrilling, but it's also strangely distanced and inhuman. By the evidence of this movie, Tarantino's talent is explosive, but amid all his dazzling ruckus, you can't detect a heartbeat.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Audrey Voblaitis. Kezia Perlman is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Brother bought a coconut, he bought it for the dime. His sister had another one, she baited for the lime. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she called the doctor, woke him up and said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor, to relieve his belly ache. I said, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor, to relieve his bellyache. Now let me get this straight. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and pulled up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and pulled up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and pulled up. Put the lime in the coconut, you called your doctor, woke him up, said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said,
major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, for Veterans Day, the story of one of the first big battles of Vietnam. The Battle of Ia Drang lasted 3 days and 2 nights. We'll talk to the general who led the battle and the journalist who risked his life to cover it. They both say it's the worst battle they've ever seen. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.